This episode of The Ready Room is brought to you by our friends at Squarespace, the easiest way to create beautiful blogs and websites and push content to your social networks.
You're listening to Trek FM.
Welcome to The Ready Room, show number 85, Bro Fighting in the 602. I'm Christopher Jones, and with me today is Greg Harbin. We'll be talking about some Star Trek news, including the new trailers for The Best of Both Worlds and Enterprise Season 1 Blu-rays, the Chateauitry app Valentine's Update, new Creo toys from Hasbro, and how Pine and Cumberbatch are trying to seduce you from Entertainment Weekly's new Star Trek Into Darkness covers. Then in the feature, we're joined by Matthew Rushing and Colin Higgins to discuss the Enterprise episode, First Flight. So let's step into the Ready Room. Hello, Greg. How are you this week?
Chris, I'm doing very well. I accidentally got sucked into this game called Skylanders, where you buy these plastic toys and then you put them on this portal and it goes into the video game. Honestly, I almost canceled the podcast this week so I could just be playing more Skylanders. So toys are a dangerous thing for an adult, Chris.
Yeah, I think you posted it to Instagram. I don't remember. You sent it to me, but it was a picture of your toys, yeah. And it said, "We may have a problem here."
Oh, and that was... So
now I understand.
That wasn't even all of them. Our collection has grown even since then.
Well, sure. I mean, they don't make a lens wide enough to capture your entire collection.
Exactly. How are things going for you in Japan, Chris?
It's going pretty well. You know, yesterday it was very sunny for the first time in a while, and it was very warm. So we took a trip down the tracks to Odawara Castle. And Odawara was a real hot point of a number of conflicts, when the Shogun were in power. And the castle down there, the inside now is sort of a museum. They have a lot of artifacts from the Edo period and before the Edo period. And it's very interesting. And every time I go in and look at that, it reminds me of what it might be like to visit Kronos and go into some sort of Klingon museum, because this is one area where the Japanese and the Klingons have a lot of similarities. When you look at all of the armor, when you look at all the weapons that were handcrafted during those wars, it's very, very fascinating. And it just really, seriously, how much of a geek I am gives me that Star Trek tie-in. It was a lot of fun.
Now, I guess my question, Chris, considering how much of a geek you are and how much this was touching you on a Star Trek level, while you were looking at the artifacts and everything, did you go ahead and knock down a room divider?
I did, yeah.
That's good.
Because I thought there might be some Andorians hiding behind it.
You never know.
Turns out it was just a couple of kids playing Pokemon
oh,
cards.
God.
So I felt kind of bad about it afterwards. But
they are everywhere.
they really are. All right. Well, let's go ahead and jump into news. First thing I want to talk about, Greg, is the trailer for The Best of Both Worlds Blu-ray, which is now available for pre-order on Amazon. It was not last time we recorded. What do you think about this trailer?
Well, the footage looks absolutely stunning. You can watch the trailer in 1080p there on YouTube, and it just looks excellent. It's not even Blu-ray quality, but you can already see the quality of the effects that they were doing in season 3 was phenomenal. And with the restoration work that CBS Digital has done, we're going to be seeing it in all of its glory. I cannot wait. I really cannot wait to see this on the big screen and then to own it myself at home.
Yeah, I actually pre-ordered it just a little bit before we went on the air. So now I've got like 17 different Star Trek items pre-ordered, I think, on Amazon.
Wow.
From the US. No, it's not that many, but it's quite a lot. And the trailer is great. I mean, it shows that this episode could be a feature film. You watch this trailer and you're like, well, I want to go see this movie. And it also made me think that there's going to be a new Star Trek tradition which is going to be watching The Best of Both Worlds Blu-ray and then watching First Contact right afterwards. That's going to be your back-to-back traditional viewing.
Oh, absolutely. And what day of the year is the traditional Best of Both Worlds First Contact viewing day?
Well, you'd have to do that on April 5th, right?
Okay. All right. Very good. That sounds great. Now, we didn't do any original research ourselves, but one the commentary Track Stars guys that we have doing commentary Track Stars did find out that it's a new cut, not just the episodes put together, but it's cut like a feature. So the commercial breaks are completely taken out. So you will be able to watch it just like a movie. So that's going to be excellent. I'm interested to see how the rhythm works, where the sort of mini cliffhangers are not cliffhangers anymore, like how that's going to work out. The trailer does mention one of the biggest cliffhangers in TV history. And it's like, well, but it's not a cliffhanger because it just keeps going when you make it feature length.
Right. I was going to say, now remove.
Yes, exactly.
Like it never existed.
Never mind.
So that's good. Mike and Max did some digging for us. And now were they able to uncover how they're going to handle the fact that Riker says Mr. Worf and they cut to Worf's face up close and then he says fire and then they come back and his makeup's different?
They didn't turn up that, unfortunately. Now, what they did find out, though, is that the commentary track is going to be director Cliff Bull, as well as Mike and Denise Okuda, as well as Elizabeth Dennehy, who, of course, played fan favorite Commander Shelby.
Well, I'm glad to hear that, because as we talked about last week, you know, we felt that the menus and everything should be Shelby-themed.
Yes.
So I'm glad they're at least going to have her on the commentary.
Yeah, I'm hoping it's like a Dennehy solo commentary track that I can listen to, where she just talks about all the parts that she was involved in and what she thinks of the rest of it. Maybe put Mike Denise on their own track and then put Cliff on his own track by himself.
Right. Like every time Riker's walking down the hall and she's like, just look at that ass.
Right, exactly.
like that woman in Encounter at Farpoint that checks Riker out after he asks for directions on the ship. She says, shows him how to use the panels.
Wait, I
which is something I
thought that was
think he should have already
Shelby.
Known.
Was that not?
That was a proto show.
Right. And actually, I do hope Dennehy and director Bull are on the same track, because I want to hear about those times when all the fan base was thinking, you know, maybe Jean-Luc Picard is leaving, you know, leaving the show, Patrick Stewart leaving the show, and Shelby's going to become a regular. And I just want to hear Cliff Bull explain to her why exactly he avoided her calls for so long.
That would be interesting to find out. Yeah, I remember that cliffhanger so well because I saw this stuff in First Run. And I guess this is a geek moment. You know, you have those moments where you remember exactly where you were when something happened. You
right.
know, like I remember exactly where I was when Reagan was shot. I remember exactly where I was when the Challenger exploded. I actually remember exactly where I was when this episode came on the first time, and we did not know it was going to be a cliffhanger. And I was actually with my girlfriend, and we were watching this, and they got to the end, and Riker says, fire. And we're like, oh, shit. And then we had actually wait the entire summer to find out what was going on. And like you today, we thought, yeah, maybe Picard's being written off the show.
Yeah, and this was before really the internet had taken off. This may be before the internet, period.
It was.
So there wasn't really an easy place to go to ask, you know, the writing staff, you know, is Patrick Stewart coming back? You had to sort of wait for TV Guide to maybe say something about it. So it was a very much just fan speculation, grassroots fan speculation.
Yeah, I kind of miss those days a bit. It was kind of fun where you could actually have suspense like that, because, you know, these days you really can't. You have to proactively avoid finding things out on your own if you don't want to know.
Yeah. Now, we know we're seeing this in the theater. Very much looking forward to that. You know, they could even show this on television. I'd love for this to be like in rotation with those like Sunday night movies that they show. As they mentioned in the trailer, this is one of the top 10 TV episodes just of any TV. So I hope now that it has this special feature length cut that it can really get the recognition it deserves and not just, you know, show up in syndication from time to time.
Yeah, I think they actually said top 100 episodes.
Okay.
But
it's up there, though.
Still,
I mean,
if you think about all the episodes,
TV. I mean, it's not just up against shows like MASH and, you know, Frasier. You know, it's up against Bosom Buddies.
Good luck right there. I mean, I think Bosom Buddies holds like 10 of the top 25 all-time episodes.
I think it does.
Well, I'm looking forward to this. As I said, I already pre-ordered, and Amazon has it for $19.99 at the moment. The list price on it is $24.99. Again, I would assume that probably around release time, they're probably going to have some kind of special deal where it's like $14.99 or something like that.
It's got to be more like $14.99. I mean, if you can buy like Labyrinth on Blu-ray for $7.99, surely Best of Both Worlds is going to come down to at least $14, if not $9.99.
Yeah, I remember when I lived in the States, places like Best Buy, and they would have, like, on release day, they would be, like, dirt cheap.
Yeah.
If you buy them on release day, that first week, you know, and then it would go back up to a somewhat normal price, but still fairly discounted.
I still feel like this should be a pack-in with the set itself. I don't see why, really, it's a standalone release where you have to basically buy both episodes in both episode sets. Yeah. And then you have to buy the feature-length cut by itself.
Yeah. Well, you know, if you go to some place like Costco or Sam's, it wouldn't surprise me at all if they did do some kind of bundle like that.
That'd be cool. I'll definitely have to be on the lookout for it. I definitely want to see this. You know, whether or not I love part two or not, I really want to see the feature edit of it just for the sake of seeing how that does with Star Trek. And as well as hearing the commentary track, I'm really excited to hear that as well.
Yeah. The special features are the key for me. While we're talking about trailers, there was another trailer that came out this week for the first season of Enterprise on Blu-ray, which is going to be released on March 26th. And when I was watching this trailer, and we're going to talk about Enterprise in the feature today, how could you watch this trailer and not think, wow, Enterprise looks like a really great show?
Yeah, it's excellent. I love how they show a lot of the great special effects. They show a lot of the makeup, but the behind the scenes, what really went into making Enterprise. I really think they need to sell people on not only watch Enterprise, but like this is an event that Enterprise is coming to Blu-ray. Sure, it's been in HD, but this is going to be really high quality. And then most of all, this is a chance for fans to discover the show for the first time. People who have seen the rest of Star Trek but never got into Enterprise, they need to realize that Enterprise is important. It's not something they can just miss. And I loved to see that CBS is really promoting it this time. They're not just dropping the Blu-rays and expecting fans to buy it. They're really, really pushing it.
Yeah, they're actually promoting it the same way that they would any of the other Star Trek properties. Really on equal footing, if you watch this trailer, with what they've been doing with the TNG Blu-rays.
Yeah. I mean, we haven't heard anything about them doing like a theatrical event, which I'd love to see Broken Bow in the theater.
I don't think they'll do that.
They won't do anything like that, but you know, they might have a trailer for it, for this Blu-ray at the theatrical event for TNG. They're definitely going to be running TV ads, giving it big promotion. And that's great to see. That's encouraging as a fan of Enterprise to see CBS not treating it as a second-class citizen.
Yeah. Maybe they could do some kind of crossover promotion with Pez. You know, they could have Enterprise character Pez dispensers. And they could have that special one for your canine friends, the little Porthos dispenser, which dispenses dog food instead of Pez candy.
I thought you were going to say it was Porthos's tail lifting up and the...
Oh, gosh.
You can do different things with the Borg attachments.
I've actually seen some little dispensers like that for pigs and cows chocolate dispensers. But I don't know if I want one of those.
Probably
personally.
Not.
Maybe it dispenses cheese.
Oh, there you go. If
that's what the Porthos one should do.
Nice.
But yeah, you know, watching the way they cut the visuals, the only little problem I have with this trailer is that they did what you know, the marketing people would do sometimes and throw in some very cheesy little quips from the characters in response to, yeah, like, it's six times the resolution of DVD. And then Tripp says, I like the sound of that. but overall, the way they cut the visuals and all, it really makes the show look exciting. It shows what a high-quality production is, and hopefully it'll get people really excited about Enterprise, and they can rediscover this great show. Although they went like 2 minutes and 20 seconds or so, and in the final couple of seconds, they threw in Faith of the Heart, which was kind of like, now, I like the theme myself personally, mm-hmm, as you know, and so do you, but it's like, let's get everyone excited about Enterprise again, and then let's remind them of that theme song, yeah, that they hate. At the very end.
Yeah, I mean, it wouldn't have even surprised me if they'd had an option to watch Enterprise without the opening credits, because that's so many times that's the only complaint people had. It's like, well, yeah, the show, yeah, looked okay, but I hated that theme song and I just couldn't get into the show.
And it's too bad because the opening credits are really fantastic.
Yeah.
But again, this is coming out March 26th. It's available for pre-order. The price at the moment is still holding at $19.99 on Amazon, I believe. But it's definitely going to come down before the actual release. And it's a 6-disc set on Blu-ray.
Yeah, I did go and pre-order both the Season 3 and the Season 1 of Enterprise Blu-rays on Amazon. I want to lock in that cheapest price. And I honestly, I don't really care what it costs. I really want to have more Star Trek on Blu-ray. I'm excited for it.
Well, Greg, Valentine's Day is coming up later this week. And not to be outdone by Commander Riker in his moves of love, William Shatner has put together an update to the Chateauitry app just for Valentine's Day.
Yes. If you wanted to see Shatner with a rose between his teeth, now, right, now is your chance.
Now is your chance. So this has a new romantic word pack, which they say will help you woo that someone special. So I'm hoping that that someone special is a Star Trek geek.
Yes.
Because I know a lot of women who probably wouldn't go out with me if I tried to woo them with a Chateauitry app recording.
Well, even if it's a Star Trek geek, we're still running into the problem of it being Shatner and old Shatner at that. I mean, this is the guy who's also trying to sell you Priceline tickets. I don't know if it's the best thing to use to woo someone. Maybe if they're already in love with you, you can use it. But maybe if you're trying to woo them, maybe throw in a little, you know, Frakesoitry.
That would be a great app. I'd like to have that one too. So you're saying it's not a good idea to do something like, I got you this lovely Valentine's Day gift at lower prices.
Right. I negotiated for your heart.
He's the love negotiator.
Yes, exactly. But I love how, I mean, the Chateauitry is a cute app idea, as we've talked about before. It is an awful lot of fun. And I love that they're not just sitting back and releasing it. They're doing these packs. Like, there was a Christmas pack for it. I don't know if we ever got a chance to talk about it. And now here's Valentine's Day. I hope they keep doing this. Like, come July 4th, maybe we can have a patriotic pack. And just keep doing whatever we can do. Get Shatner back in that voice booth whenever we can.
What about an Easter pack? You could talk about hiding the eggs and such.
Yes. Hopping from here to there, I bring you candy.
In the form of a rabbit.
Yes.
Have a little shore leave theme going.
Yes.
In that one, I think would be cool.
Yeah. The problem is when he goes in and paints all of the rabbits purple.
He blew the whole budget.
Yes.
That update, it only has like 10 new words
because, yeah,
they spent all the money painting the rabbits purple and then taking photos of them for the wallpapers.
Man. And that rock monster add-on pack that they tried, it just never really worked. The effects just never quite sold me.
But anyway, the Chateauitry app, it really is fun to play with. And they have been improving the functionality quite a bit. They've been making it a little bit easier for you to choose your words. And they've prettified, they say, the Get More Words menu, which is always welcome. And hey, it's Valentine's Day, so you right. need to prettify that.
I still, they need to have like Siri integration so I can speak into it what I want to say and it'll just pop it awesome. On there. Having to go yeah. through word by word and it's still missing a lot of words. Yeah. It's still a little frustrating, but you know, if you can get the right thing out, it sometimes is completely worth it.
It definitely is. Siri integration would be awesome because I have those ideas, but yeah, there is a lot of hunting and pecking that you have to do to get to the words. But, if you have the Chateau Atrie app, if you have not yet run an update recently, go to your App Store app and run the update and you'll get the whole Valentine's pack. And if you don't have it, just go to the App Store and search for Chateau Atrie or use the link on the show notes page here and you'll be able to get the app. The one thing that they do is that after these holidays pass, they actually release another update that removes the themed content.
Yeah.
So if you do want to check out the Valentine's stuff, go grab it now. I don't know how soon they'll remove it, but I would imagine, you know, a week after Valentine's probably it'll disappear. So if you want to see Shatner with a rose in his mouth, you better hop on over there right now.
All right, Chris, well, I think it's about time to take a moment and have you tell us about something you like.
Well, Greg, you know what I like? You know what I really like? What I really like is our sponsor, Squarespace, and I'm really serious about that. They do make it possible for us to bring you the shows, but beyond that, you know, I've been using Squarespace for years. Even before I even started Trek FM, I've been using Squarespace, and it has made my life as a web designer and a content creator immensely easier.
Yeah, I love that it has a drag-and-drop interface. That's the one thing that really strikes me. Every time I don't have a site of my own really to do, but I like, you know, I work in Trek FM and I want to be able to help you out with that. So I've been playing around with Squarespace 6 a little bit. I like, you can just grab like a picture and stick it right in there and just put it there. I can do HTML. You know, I think most of the listeners of the show can do at least some HTML, but the internet's gotten so complicated where you have to learn CSS and JavaScript and all this stuff just to make the website look the way you want it. Squarespace makes it so much easier.
You know, what's really cool, you mentioned the drag and drop in the images. Some of the technology behind Squarespace is really amazing. One thing that it has that is great for building richer websites and richer blogs and getting, when you get a site as large as Trek FM and you have so much content and you want to make sure people can find that content, and you're able to assign an image thumbnail to every post. You're also able to specify whether a post is a featured post or not a featured post. And what's cool about the images in the image thumbnail is they have this little circle. It's called a focal point. And the system makes some decisions for you about how it displays the thumbnail image to represent your post based on what kind of template you're using. And you can actually drag this little circle around the image and set the focal point within Squarespace so it knows that when it serves up this thumbnail, it's going to shift the image up and down or left and right so that wherever you put that dot is the center of the image when it's shown as a thumbnail. And that's, it's really amazing to me. I've been doing this for so long, and I'm so used to having to create images that are exactly the way I want them to display in every situation. And it saves me so much time because I can create one image and then I can actually tell the system just by dragging my finger on my trackpad where I want that focal point to be. And that has been a very impressive feature and a huge time saver for me.
That's phenomenal. I mean, those guys at Squarespace, they know the internet. They know how you want it to work. Like, they know that you want people to be able to see it on their, you know, their 1080p 3D television all the way down to their iPhone. And they know that the web has to work in different ways, but you also don't want to have to build an iPad site. You know, I see even people like ABC have this terrible mobile version of their site. Just like, no, just have a, if they had a system that scaled down the site so it looked just a little bit different automatically, it would save them so much effort and make it better for the readers as well. So I think you're finding that as well, that people are going to enjoy looking at the site, however they're looking at it because of the incredible stuff that Squarespace is doing behind the scenes.
You mentioned Trek FM and a large site, Greg, and the last two points I want to hit on today are the fact that you can have contributors. You know, Trek FM, we have a lot of editors, and we are able to assign different people as contributors. And so, you know, I can go in and post things and edit. You can, Shar can, Landrew, whoever can go in, and you can assign the privileges that those users have to edit the site. And it's so easy. And then the other thing is that Squarespace is search engine optimized. And that may sound like a throwaway phrase. Everyone's into SEO these days. But, you know, what's wonderful about Squarespace is that they do all the work for you. They make sure everything in the code is set so that it's optimal for search engines, and you just worry about your content. And that's, I think, the way it should be. So give it a try. Squarespace has a special offer for Trek FM listeners. If you go to squarespace.com/trek, you can try it free for 14 days. There's absolutely no obligation on your part. You know, they don't ask you for a credit card. You just go sign up. You get access for 14 days to every feature in Squarespace. You can build a site. You can take it for a spin yourself. And we promise you that you'll love it and you'll want to sign up. And when you do sign up, you can use offer code TREK2. That's TREK2 because this is February now. And that'll get you 10% off of your lifetime purchase with Squarespace. The pricing is extremely reasonable. The unlimited package, which gives you all the bells and whistles, is only $16 a month. And if you don't think you need that, they also have another package for $8, which gives you pretty much everything you would need, you know, if you were building a blog, personal website anyway. But the $16 package gives you all the power to build a website as large as you can imagine. So go check them out, squarespace.com/trek, and use offer code TREK2, and you'll be supporting Trek FM, helping us bring this programming to you and supporting our sponsor at the same time.
And actually, Chris, I'm thinking of using Squarespace to build my new Skylanders fan site, where I just talk about what I'm doing with all of my new Skylanders toys, all bazillion of them. But I guess more Star Trek specific, I suppose I could open a fan site for these new Creo toys that they're releasing, which actually look really cool. Not sure why they're not Legos. I don't know why Lego isn't doing Star Trek, but Hasbro has the license and is doing a bang-up job with Star Trek.
Oh, that could be the case, yeah. Hasbro just generally having the license.
Yeah.
That Lego can't get a split license. I have no idea there, to be sure. But you know what's really cool about these, Greg, though, is that these are the Star Trek Into Darkness toys that are coming out. And it kind of gives us some hints about what's going to happen in the movie. If you look at the different sets that are coming out, one of them is the Klingon Bird of Prey building set. Mm-hmm. And you've got the little Klingon figures and they've got their helmets on and they've got a batleth, which looks a lot like the batleths that we're accustomed to. Now it's kind of hard to tell with the toys about the actual design of the Bird of Prey, but the coloring here is a lot more like the Bird of Prey that we saw in Balance of Terror. The design seems to be somewhere in between that and what we're accustomed to with the Bird of Prey from TNG era.
Yeah, I don't know quite what to pull out of this. I would assume from seeing this that there will be, if not a D7 class, you know, some sort of alternate Klingon ship in the movie. You know, they've also got toys for the Kelvin and the jellyfish, so that's a little odd that they're putting those in as well.
Yeah. It's true, but I just kind of feel like the fact that there is a Bird of Prey set,
yeah,
and the Klingons have these little helmets on, that this is a tie-in because the toy companies have to know what's happening in the movie.
Right.
Well, they don't have to. I mean, we've seen stumbles in the past where toy companies didn't know in advance and they weren't able to release toys. So maybe they've learned from that here, because we also have the Spock's Volcano Mission building set.
Yeah, and, so you can, you too can do the excitement of wondering whether to save your friend or honor some sort of abstract mission statement that's not really followed that often.
Right.
Now, what I'm wondering about, though, okay, so we've got the Vulcan mission set that we've seen in the IMAX trailer. We also have the Transporter Trouble building set that comes with the Transporter, as well as Scotty, as well as a Klingon. So this is that exciting scene where Scotty beams a Klingon onto the ship?
I think that might be it. And then there's a transporter accident, and then the Klingon and Keenzer, they get accidentally merged, kind of like Tuvix. So now you've got this like really, really short guy running around with a helmet and a really pissy attitude, just tearing up the ship.
Nice. That's Klingzer?
Klingzer, that's right, yeah.
Now this Klingon in the actual set, he does come with a Batleth. And it looks a little different from the Batleth we're accustomed to. You know, Jadzia asked for that very specific Batleth, and then it ended up being just the same one we've seen. This one actually looks a little different. There's a little, some extra pieces going off. Glad to see JJ sticking with the Batleth, not inventing some new sort of lens flare weapon for the Klingons.
That is good. Although I would love to see a lens flare weapon.
Yes.
I have to admit.
And I do wonder if the helmet comes off the Klingon. Like, we're dying to see what the Klingons look like in the JJ verse. And so far, all of them have had this incredible, like, complete skull covering helmet. And even the Creo toy has it.
What I think is going to happen, and I haven't seen the exact release date on these toys yet. I've only seen that they are arriving this spring. But I think they're going to come out before the movie. And the helmet, this is really high tech. I'm really impressed with Hasbro here, actually. You cannot actually remove the helmet until after the movie is released in theaters. And then there's like this time release thing in there. The helmet will come off afterwards because they don't want to spoil anything for you in advance.
No, that makes perfect sense. Maybe you have to use your Qualcomm Star Trek app to scan it and play a certain series of chirps, and then that unlocks the helmet.
Right, and it goes, and then you can slide it off.
And then it sort of stumbles out, and Palpatine's looking on, smiling, and the Klingon goes, "No!"
Exactly. Well, why not? I mean, you know, with JJ taking over Star Trek and Star Wars both, why not?
Yes.
Let's just go ahead and mix these things together here. That's how Lego is going to get the license to Star Trek, by the way. They're just
right.
Going to start. They're going to package. It's going to be Star Wars / Star Trek Lego play sets.
Right. Now, the last thing I do see that I want to mention was the figure pack, which includes quite a selection of different creatures. You know, it says it's got a Gorn, Captain Nero, a Keenzer, a Grazia, a Klingon, Lieutenant Sprong. I'm not familiar with Lieutenant Sprong.
Lieutenant Sprong. Maybe I should know this, but I kind of don't. And the image that I have seen is just simply not large enough for me to be able to see the details of Lieutenant Sprong here.
Yeah.
So.
Well, and one of these figures in the picture that's at the StarTrek.com site looks like those aliens from Countdown to Darkness #1.
Right, yeah.
So I'm wondering if those are going to be featured in the movie, or if this is just them doing comic figures, which that would seem odd, right? That we would do that.
It would seem odd because when you make these toys, you generally are making them for the mainstream audience. And so you would want them to be familiar with the characters. And if they were only going to appear in Countdown to Darkness 1 and maybe 2, I doubt they would put them here.
Yeah. Although they also have the Gorn, which I'm assuming is just because of the game. You think we're going to see Gorn in Into Darkness?
Well, that's a good question. I hadn't even thought about that. The fact that they're centering the game, which is supposed to be part of the lead up to the movie, around the Gorn, maybe. I mean, I don't think Gorn would play any major role in the movie, but maybe they would encounter a Gorn.
Right. I don't know. I mean, maybe Harrison is building an army that are, you know, these guys from Countdown to Darkness. He's got the Gorn. He's trying to recruit the Klingons, that sort of thing.
You know what it is, actually? I know what the secret of Harrison is now. He's actually a Gorn. If you rip his skin, you can see that he is a reptile underneath.
So this is like those guys from V.
Yes. We're just it's the consolidation of entertainment. We're just bringing all the different franchises under JJ's wing now.
All right. I guess that V primetime TV reboot didn't work, so they just gave it to JJ and he's going to make it also be the Star Trek film. That's phenomenal. Right. I'm looking forward to that.
All right. So these toys are interesting in that they give us some potential insights into what we might see in the movie. Plus, it would just be great fun, you know, to get them, go down to McDonald's with your 20-something-year-old friends, hang out for the night, grab some fries and a milkshake, and play with your Hasbro Creo toys at your local McDonald's. Not that anyone on this show would ever do that, but...
No.
All right, Greg, as we fully move into movie news and rumors, which we kind of slowly segued into there in our toy discussion, there's something coming out this week, which is one of the few moments where I wish that I lived in the U.S. because, you know, over the years, I've come to not really miss things so much anymore because I'm very acclimated here. But these Entertainment Weekly covers for Star Trek Into Darkness are hitting the newsstands. They're collector's covers, and it's just something that's not really feasible for me to get my hands on over here in printed form.
Yeah, they're really fantastic covers. I may need to get myself to a newsstand to get them. Although I think the photographer, well, you know, last week we were a little bedazzled by Jerry Ryan's lips. I think the photographer, the people at EW... may have a thing for not only the lips of Chris Pine, but also Benedict Cumberbatch.
I think you might be right here. Yeah, I mean, I really feel like they are both trying to seduce me through the cover of Entertainment Weekly.
I mean, really, I mean, Pine is pouting with his lips, but I don't know. Cumberbatch, he's not doing that dark, stern look that we saw in Empire. He's a little bit more come hither on the AW cover. I don't know what sort of look he's giving me.
I like the cover with Kirk and Spock, where Kirk is giving you these eyes, and he's like gazing at you. And then behind him, Spock is going like, "Don't you fracking look at my captain. I will kick your ass if you look at his lips again."
Absolutely, yes.
Man, Spock looks pissed on that cover.
He really does. He's showing more emotion in this picture than I kind of hope he does in the film. Vulcans aren't really supposed to show that much emotion, but I'm really getting this hands off my captain look from him.
The other thing is that's one of two collector's covers, and I can just picture these being on the newsstand next to each other, and you're looking at the one with Cumberbatch, and Spock is going, "Yeah, you don't even think about buying that cover. We are the first win. You buy us first."
Right.
Damn it.
Another thing I like about these covers is that they seem to have bought into the idea that there's lens flares everywhere.
Everywhere.
There's lens flares all over these covers. It's not even like they were actual flashlights. They just stuck some lens flares on. It's like, oh, that's what Star Trek looks like now.
Right, yeah. You know, I'm actually planning to go over to the eyeglass shop here where I got my glasses. I'm going to get these new lenses that they've just come out with. They're actually bad robot licensed lenses. They're prescription lenses, which is great. But what they do is they actually immerse you in a world of lens flares. So that, like, for you, real life is just filled with lens flares all the time.
That's phenomenal. It's sort of like the opposite of the anti-glare coating they put on. It's like extra glare.
Extra glare. It says lens flare coating, and it has a little registered trademark after it. Yeah. It's got a picture of JJ next to it.
Now, the other thing about Entertainment Weekly is that there was a little bit of intrigue this week that we should talk about, in that there was a thing on the EW website where if you tried to order a backlog version of this issue, it actually described it as the Kirk and Khan cover. Not Kirk and Harrison, but actually said Kirk and Khan. Now,
interesting.
We still don't really know what to make of this. We know the article itself doesn't mention Khan at any point except to say rumors suggest Harrison could be Khan. There's no sort of confirmation in the issue itself. But it's a little odd that a reference to Khan would make it onto their website in such a blatant way.
Yeah, it is. I mean, it could be a couple of things. The first thing that pops into mind for me is that it could just be a designer at EW who believes that this is Khan, and they named the file Kirk and Khan cover, and then someone else picked it up and that got typed out on the page, Kirk and Khan edition. It could just be something like that. I do wonder if someone like EW would actually have access to the script, because if they do know that many details, then I would think that it means that JJ in the studio want some things to be leaked. Otherwise, you would not reveal that information to a publication like Entertainment Weekly.
I'm getting to the point of feeling like there have been a lot of off-the-record comments. Not anything that's publishable, but that there's a lot of people who just know that it is Khan. We're getting to that point where it sort of was the same way with the JJ announcement that he's directing Star Wars. Enough people know off the record that it just is basically out there.
Yeah.
But nothing's confirmed.
Yeah. But I firmly believe that Khan is in the movie, and I have some reasons to believe that beyond what we've talked about on here as well. And my only question really is Cumberbatch Khan or is Peter Weller Khan? But I really, really do believe that Khan is in this movie.
Right. Or is Carl Urban playing Khan? You know, he really is such a versatile actor. Maybe he has got a dual role in this film.
Maybe so. I mean, that would throw everyone off track for sure. All right. Well, another thing that is out there from Entertainment Weekly are some more photos from Star Trek Into Darkness. And the one that really stood out to me most, Greg, was the scene here where apparently Darth Vader has knocked Kirk's lightsaber out of his hand, and Kirk is about to fall through that tunnel in Cloud City, and he's just hanging on for dear life.
It is your destiny.
Oh, I thought this was the scene where Darth Maul had just stabbed Qui-Gon Jinn and then kicked Kirk down this shaft, and he lost his lightsaber, and now he's just standing up there taunting him.
They both work.
He is just holding on for dear life. Oh, goodness. I comparisons to Star Wars aside, here's another case of somebody dangling off of something. This looked to be the movie of people jumping off of things. You know, we've got them jumping off the cliff. We've got Spock jumping off of a building or a spaceship or something.
We've got starships jumping out of space into San Francisco Bay.
Exactly. But here's a little bit of dangling. Like, the first film had a lot of dangling. It's good to see that Kirk hasn't forgotten how.
That's right. There's another one here, and this made its rounds, you know, over the past few days, of Cumberbatch surrounded by red shirts. I love just the scene of all the red shirts around him personally. It's just got this great TOS flavor to it.
Well, I thought this was a bit like Where's Waldo? Like, oh, it's just this nice picture of a bunch of red shirts. But if you look really, really closely, you might notice that the villain of the film is actually in the picture.
They did make it kind of hard, didn't they? It's one of those trickier Where's Waldo books, or is it known in Japan as Where's Wally for some reason?
Oh, yes, Where's Wally. And then we've got another picture that's just Kirk and Spock together. It looks like maybe they're standing in front of that glass room that Cumberbatch is being held in. You know, just standard publicity shots. Not too much to jump up and down over. But it is good to see them releasing bits and bits rather than that media blackout that we had for so long.
Now, I do like the suit that Uhura is wearing. This is some kind of really tight latex suit she's got on here. We can only see her from, you know, basically shoulders up. But I'm looking forward to this scene in the movie.
Yeah, it's fancy. I believe that's from the IMAX scene. If I remember correctly, that is actually her scuba diving suit that she wears. Oh. And that's also, if you recall, the Chris Pine Too Much Junk suit that we're going to get early on in the film.
That's right.
So
that's right.
Those people who liked those pouting lips from earlier can very much look forward to the first 9 minutes of the film.
So we've got everything in this movie. We're going to go into a volcano. We're going to go scuba diving. I mean, is there a scene of them? I think there is, of them running through a cornfield, except it's red.
It's sort of a red alien cornfield. Yeah. Now, this film has everything.
It's like that scene in Signs where they're running through the cornfield, except it's going to be a red cornfield.
Exactly.
What else? Are they going to make pottery in this movie? It seems like they're just doing absolutely everything that you can possibly imagine.
They're throwing everything into this one. I'm to the point where there's been so much thrown at us that I'm not sure what to expect when I go in. I know where the film starts, but I really still don't have any idea where it's heading. And, you know, the film's 3 months out at this point. And to still not know really what the plot is, I hope they can keep it at this level where they're just releasing a little bit of pictures here and there, keep the excitement going. But don't really talk about plot. Don't really spoil it for those of us who want to go in, you know, mostly unsure of what's going to happen.
I feel like there's a lot more excitement about this movie at this point prior to release than there was for the last movie, which I think speaks something about the success of this whole concept, whether you like it or not. I mean, boy, it's really put Star Trek... When was the last time that Star Trek, well, maybe 2009, but prior to this Abramsverse reboot stuff, when was the last time that Star Trek had EW covers like this leading into some kind of event?
Oh, yeah. I mean, the first film felt very much like that first Pirates of the Caribbean film where nobody really knew what it was going to be. The actors in it were kind of well-known, but not really action stars. No one was really super excited for Pirates. But now... people know what Star Trek is. The people know this reboot. Chris Pine has blossomed into a big star. Benedict Cumberbatch has a huge fan base as well that's, you know, sort of the target audience for Star Trek, but not people who are already Trekkies. I think that was a really key move that they made casting him. And that's helping the film have a much bigger splash. You know, you can put Benny and Chris on the cover of EW, and people are going to know who they are. It's going to make them excited about actually seeing the film.
Yeah, right. Even if they don't care about Star Trek.
Yeah.
They're like, there's Chris Pine, there's Zachary Quinto, and there's Benedict Cumberbatch. I got to go see this.
Yeah, exactly. So I think that's part of the bigger profile. I'm hoping it's going to open big. Like, hopefully there can still be this big of a push come May.
Enterprise began right out of the gate with the mission of the NX-01, and we didn't get a lot of background to the NX program until First Flight came along in the second season. And then we learned a little bit about Archer, his background, the background of the ship, and how he came to know Trip. And today we're going to talk about First Flight, and to help us do that, we have with us from Literary Treks and The Orb, Matthew Rushing. Hello, Matthew.
Hello, Chris. How are you doing? Good to be here.
Great. And also with us, it's been a long time since he's been on the Ready Room, but he's one of the far-flung members of the Trekium family who has the advantage of living in the UK, which means his time zone doesn't match up with ours most of the time. It's Colin Higgins.
Yes, yes. It's a distinct disadvantage at times living in the UK, but it's great to be back on the Ready Room again, so thanks for having me.
Well, we're glad you're on, Colin. We try to get you on the show often. I mean, I want to have you on, but boy, those time zones between the US, Japan, and the UK are really tough.
Yeah, and I do appreciate Greg and Matt coming on early to accommodate my time.
Mm. Absolutely.
Absolutely.
Oh, definitely.
Pleasure to speak with you, finally.
But of course, Trek FM listeners know you from Trek News and Views and from Decade, so... And you're a huge Enterprise fan, and Trek News and Views does a lot of Enterprise coverage. So we're glad to have you talk about First Flight with us today.
Yeah. Yeah. I do like Enterprise. Much my line series.
Hmm. It really is. So, Colin, why don't you kick us off with First Flight here?
Well, First Flight, what can you say about First Flight? It's basically the inaugural flight of the Warp 2 engine. It's also where we get to find a bit of backstory about Jonathan Archer and his early days as a test pilot before he became the NX captain. We also get a bit of background story on the actual Vulcan view in relation to humanity's expansion of its warp facilities. And we get some tender moments as well with T'Pol. And we also find out some origins about Trip and Archer's relationship, which kind of diversifies later on in the series.
And we also got another Admiral uniform. Well, I guess in this case, a Commodore uniform.
He's a Commodore, yeah.
Yeah. And I got to say, this is a nice uniform. I mean, it's got a tie.
Yeah.
It zips down the front, so you know the Commodore can get very comfortable whenever he needs to real quickly. I mean, this is the uniform that I want. I mean, and later we see that Admirals wear this too, so... This is high quality stuff. Yeah. Enterprise really got the Admiral's uniform right. And then who knows what the hell happened for the rest of the series?
Well, yeah, but I was going to say, do you think that Commodore's uniform there, is that the genesis of the whole Starfleet Fashion School Admiral's specialization program?
I think it definitely is. I mean, it starts with the tie. Like sometimes you wear your black tie, sometimes you wear your power red tie, but then you get killed when you go on an away mission. So that... Not usually a good plan, but so they stopped, they moved away from the tie, and they started changing all sorts of other things. I definitely think it started here.
I'm just surprised that Riker never ended up in this outfit, because it's so easy to get in and out of. You know, being able to perform the Riker maneuver quite easily.
Why do you think Riker spends so much time in that Enterprise simulation on the Enterprise D?
On the holodeck.
I thought it was because he got a kiss to Paul.
Oh, God. Stop it. Make it stop, please.
Well, you notice too that they hadn't added the nice belt buckle yet. There was no nice belt around the middle to accentuate how large admirals get, and how large their belt buckle was to compensate for other things. And so, unfortunately, Commodore Forrest doesn't get the belt buckle just yet.
Yeah, this is definitely pre-belt buckle. You can really tell this is a prequel series.
Okay, well, prequel series. This is the first topic we want to talk about. We've mentioned this on the Ready Room several times in recent weeks or months anyway, but the idea that Brandon Braga has said that the original concept that they wanted for Enterprise, if the studio had let them do it, would have been to have the first season be somewhat like we see in First Flight, where it's actually about the development of the NX ships before they actually set out into space. So instead of jumping right out of the gate with a full-fledged Warp 5 ship and we got to take a Klingon to Kronos, we would have seen this sort of Earth-based development. And what do you guys think about that as a concept for the show and an entire first season of that?
I think it would have been an interesting concept to see the developments, because basically in relation to the view, we went from Seth and Cochrane to the NX. Obviously, you've got the opening segments where you've got the evolution of the ships in the opening segments, but we don't actually see that evolution. So I think it would have been interesting to see that.
Yeah, and this episode itself is fantastic. I mean, as a sort of lost pilot episode for that original series concept, it's really excellent. I would have loved to see this as that. I don't know if it's enough to sustain a series for an entire season or a couple seasons, though. That's the only thing I would worry about. Like, do they hang out in the 602 Club all the time? Do we have, like, B-plots involving Ruby? Do we follow her home, find out, you know, what she's getting up to in her off hours?
Well, I mean, she does date Trip and Reed, so that's what she's getting up to.
Well, that's true.
She's a busy woman.
Well, I think that this, I mean, I don't know if any of y'all have ever read The Right Stuff by Tom Wolfe or at least seen the movie, but it's the story of the test pilots for the American Air Force testing all the spaceships and all the things that will happen to get us into space the first time. And it's a fantastic book, and he really places you inside this world and makes you feel like you're there. And I think that that's what this episode does here for the NXO program. And I think that it would have been a fantastic first season to give us something like this, to give us some backstory and history and really see the development from, you know, Zefram Cochran to the point when the Enterprise is launched. You know, Brannon just said in an interview he did with Geek Magazine, they had a big panel of guys together talking about the place of Star Trek and where it's going and where it's been. And he said that he would have had, you know, the end of the season be, you know, the Klingon lands, you know, all that happens in Broken Bow, but that would have been the season finale. Honestly, I think that's a fantastic idea. Because as a Star Trek fan, I think I would have been brought into it more than just being fed, oh, well, we're already in space, and this is the same trope you've already seen a million times, and we're not going to change the formula. But the studio wouldn't let him do it.
Yeah, well, that's a good point there. As a Star Trek fan, you say, because I think for me, just in terms of what I like to watch on television, what kind of stories I like, I think it's a great concept. I think it would have made a very interesting show. One thing I like about Enterprise is that it was a break from the formula that we had through TNG, DS9, Voyager. Especially by the time you get to the end of Voyager, the whole Star Trek look and feel and the type of story, it starts feeling very formulaic to me, because we've had so many episodes set in the 24th century. And, you know, anything that you do, you get into a routine and you get to where it's almost like autopilot that you can do these things. And it kind of felt like that sometimes in terms of Star Trek by the time we got to the end of Voyager. So I like that Enterprise was a complete break from that, and the look and the feel and everything was so different. What I wonder about often, though, and when I think about why Enterprise wasn't more successful, I think there are some fans like us who would love to see those blanks filled in. And we like the idea of having something very different that tells us that backstory. I think that a larger percentage of the fan base just wanted more of the 24th century stuff. And so I think that if they had gone with this concept, they would have alienated the fan base even more so than they already did by just the overall style of Enterprise.
What they should have done was have another show following Voyager in the 24th century, continuing that storyline for the fans, and then do a show that's very different. You know, do that show just set on Earth in the prequel time, and that way you get a chance to branch out and tell different types of stories. I think by trying to split the difference with where they were at with Enterprise in season two, they really lost the core of what they were doing by saying, let's do something different. They were so worried about pleasing those hardcore fans that they were kind of missing what they were going for creatively.
I think the studio was concerned about pleasing the hardcore fans. I think that Braga and Berman were interested in doing something completely different.
Exactly. And so by the studio pulling them towards doing Enterprise the way it ended up, we didn't end up with it. Whereas they've been able to tell the studio, look, we're doing, you know, the Titan series. Don't worry about it. We're covering those bases, and we're going to do a different type of show. I think that could have been really successful.
This is why Star Trek needs to always be syndicated.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. I don't.
And talk to the fans.
Yeah, I'm not sure. Mm-hmm. I mean, when I think about it as myself as a fan, when I was watching Enterprise for the first time, I think I came away with it as just, wow, this really isn't that much different. It's just set time before, but it still feels just like, you know, what we have already been doing for the last like 20 years. What I didn't understand, and what I think might have what I personally think would have revitalized fans, was giving it that right stuff feel and making it feel like this is different. This is not Kirk. This is not Picard. This is not freaking Janeway. This is Archer. This is his time, and everything is a little bit grittier. It's a little bit more realistic, and it feels like something that you can really connect to. And yeah, everybody's going to be a little bit more gung-ho. Everybody's going to be a little bit more green. And that's really going to set you up for what you're going to see later on in Kirk and Picard and all of those people. I don't know. I feel like that might have been what could have drawn fans in, because, you know, we just lull them in with, well, this is Enterprise, but it just feels like a continuation of Voyager almost. It's just set in an earlier time period because all the stories seem the same. There's nothing really new to captivate me.
Yeah, the storytelling concept is quite similar. So let's talk about storytelling concepts. And, you know, this is another, kind of like Carbon Creek was, this is another let me tell you a story episode.
Yeah, it's cute the way they do it. I mean, they set up this kind of really dumb science experiment.
I know.
Just so that, I mean,
hey, that's sure. The A-plot, Greg. That's the A-plot you're talking about.
That's the A-plot, exactly. That's the important part. I'm sure there's people who leave this episode thinking, that was a really interesting, you know, a really interesting diving into what it's like to explore for nebulas. You know, the way science works, sometimes you have to keep trying and keep working at it and working at it, and then eventually you succeed. I'm sure that's the takeaway some people get.
I liked the fact that they set this up so that we can have a character story, because that's really what this is, you know, is they're going to give us a character story. And it's not just a bottle show, because they spent some money on creating some of these sets and they did a lot of digital work here. And so they actually tell a really good story for us. You know, we're not left, you know, if we are in Carbon Creek, is this true? Is this not true? Maybe it's true. Well, it's probably true. You know, this is a real story from the past of Archer and Trip. And I think that makes it all the more special, because it really starts to connect in a lot of ways our characters, and it's just great character writing. I mean, this is the kind of stuff that they would do on Deep Space Nine that we would just eat up, because it let us know what our characters were.
Yeah. I do like how much of history is not apparently in the history books. Like, you have to actually talk to a bunch of people to get any idea of what actually happened in the past.
The Vulcans erased them all.
Yeah.
That's something that you kind of see in that new Federation First 150 Years book, which I think made it so good. You see that, is that history doesn't come just from the people that write it. It comes from all the people who are involved in it. And this is one of those stories that helps us see history is a lot more complicated than we ever thought.
Yeah. I think that's true. And of course, in the case of Federation, the first 150 years, I mean, you know, David's going in, he's actually filling in the blanks, you know, as a fiction writer. But in real life, I mean, it's true. We can read our history books and we can get the official accounts of what happened, but you know that that's only scraping the surface of what actually did happen. So in a way, I like the way this is done in this episode, that, yeah, you know, you can finally, from the person who was there, you can actually get the real story.
And it's really using the characters, because you have T'Pol as this outsider who doesn't know the story, but is also close to Archer. So she's somebody Archer can sort of open up to. You know, he couldn't open up like this to Trip, because, you know, Trip knows the story. Reed, you know, is too, you know, too Starfleet to really get into it with him. But T'Pol, I feel like he sort of figured, well, T'Pol doesn't really care, so I'll just start talking. And then T'Pol just slowly makes him open up more and more. I love using T'Pol like this.
What did you think about the very, very ending that I heard it was cut, but it's going to be on the Blu-ray set? where Archer goes back to his quarters and he pulls out his old gym bag from when he was in the NX program.
Right. Just takes it out and looks at it.
Yeah.
Folds it up and puts it back.
You asked me to tell you a story.
Right.
That's right.
I really think he should have punched this one up a little bit. I mean, there's like that bar fight between him and AG. Where's the Andorian?
I'll take your blood to Andorra.
I mean, this is his chance to really take some creative license with the story. You know, maybe they didn't just go warp, 1.2. Maybe they went warp 10. Maybe AG and Archer ended up as salamanders. I don't know what they were doing, but, this is Archer's chance to really,
embellish upon the
embellish
story.
The story.
This story just got crazy.
just as they find the Dark Nebula, what he should do is, as they find the Dark Nebula, he should turn around to Pod and say, gotcha.
Well, I think that what's going to happen is we're going to get that season 2 Blu-ray, and they're going to go back in and give us the special edition of this. So they are going to add an Andorian into that fight scene. It's going to be great.
And a barrel roll.
A barrel roll, exactly. I mean, this is going to be the fight scene of all fight scenes for Star Trek.
Yeah, and it's also a unique episode of Star Trek in many other ways because, I mean, Jeffrey Combs, he's not actually in it.
Yeah, and he's everywhere.
That's strange. True.
He is everywhere.
I know. You know, there's that Vulcan who's always standing in the background just scowling at everyone. Why wasn't that Jeffrey Combs?
That would have been great.
Well, speaking of that, this is just a thought that popped in my head as I was watching it. Is it wrong that there are Vulcans just hovering in the room while the humans conduct their warp flights? Was it that
just
weird?
Yeah, I mean, they're in like their elaborate ceremonial robes, standing in that tiny flight control, just watching.
And they're not
just hanging out.
They're not doing anything. They're just standing there over your shoulder.
It does tie in nicely into Breaking the Ice because you got the Vulcan ship that says, "We've been watching you for 2 years."
Yeah. Right.
So obviously, these Vulcans have been watching them build this ship for 2 years.
It feels like the silence from Doctor Who. Allons-y! Where they're just always there, they're just watching you, but nobody looks at them, nobody pays attention.
And in this case, when the Vulcans say, "We've been watching you for 2 years," what they mean is, we've been standing like 2 feet away from you in small rooms, staring at you for 2 years while you acted like we weren't there.
Yeah. It's like mannequins. We only move when you turn around.
Exactly.
Right. Oh, goodness. Well, do you guys want to talk any more about the A-plot, which I've noted is dark matter is purple? Because I did like the fact that they addressed dark matter in this episode because it's a case where Star Trek is taking one of our current scientific questions that we're really trying to figure out, and we really still don't have much of a lead on what dark matter is, other than we know that it's got to be there because if something wasn't there, then, all the galaxies would fly apart. But they're saying here that even in the 22nd century, we have warped capabilities. We're starting to go out into space. We've made all these scientific advances. We still don't know what this stuff is.
Even the Vulcans don't know it.
Yeah.
And they've been supposedly exploring for centuries.
Right.
What I really like about this A-plot is that I like that the faith Archer has here. You know, as an explorer, Archer believes that this dark matter nebula is there, one, and that they can do something to actually excite it in a way that, to Paul and the Vulcans and just about everybody else is like, probably not, so they're not even going to try. But this faith that Archer has that they can make a difference, that they can actually do this kind of exploring, helps them actually do the job that they're out there to do. In the same way that, Einstein believes in relativity before he can prove it, or Galileo believes that the Earth revolves around the sun before he can prove it. Columbus, the Earth. I mean, all of these men believe in something before they can actually prove that it is, and it's because of their belief and their faith that they're able to actually change the world. And it's what makes good people, discoverers, and it's what makes Archer, I think, a good captain, a good choice. And that's, for me, what I get out of this A story. Yeah, it's really the B plot because, you know, it doesn't get as much time, but it is really giving us a great picture of what makes a good explorer. And it's faith that I can actually go out and do something.
Yeah, I think the fundamental bit here is the human need for knowledge and the quest for discovery, whereas the Vulcans seem to rest on the laurels in some respects. You know, going back to Breaking the Ice, when you've got the comet, which T'Pol says has only been recorded, was it four times by Vulcans, but the Vulcan captain is more interested in watching the humans than scanning this, whereas Archer is like, you know, oh, it's a comet, we need to look at it. And T'Pol says, yeah, it's just a comet. And he says, no, it's not. It's the first comet that we've come across. We need to know about this. We need to explore this. And I think that's a human thing. You know, like Matt mentioned the Columbus and that. You've got like Magellan with the Magellan Straits by Argentina. You've got Shackleton with the Northwest Passage. It's a human need. We need to know what's out there and why. And I think that's what this plays into.
It's all about that final scene when they finally do get the fireworks to trigger the whole nebula, and T'Pol's in the back and she's scanning it and you know, trying to take readings. And Archer says, no, come look at it. And they just stand up there in the cockpit, gazing out into space, looking at how beautiful it is. That's the human difference, at least as Star Trek shows it. Yeah. We want to be there. We want to touch it, you know, as Picard wanted to touch the Phoenix in First Contact. It's experiential. It's not just about gathering data.
But would T'Pol get the emotional context of what Archer's trying to convey there when he says, look at it, it's beautiful?
I think she does. I think you can see her standing there, you know, sitting there, and she's resisting it. She's resisting the feels.
Yeah,
she's resisting. But she's got it. She knows what it is.
Yeah. Well, I have to say, I really like that scene because I think Scott Bakula just nails it. His facial expressions and everything conveys that sense of like innocence and wonder that Archer has of that just pure exploration of the galaxy. And I have to say, I love, you know, Bakula's performance in this whole episode. But in general, and I know people have either liked or not liked him and kind of thought he wasn't the greatest, but I think he's perfect for this role. And this is the episode that I keep going back to and saying, man, this guy nails this character in every single way.
Yeah, he really does. I mean, I love the scene where he is trying to convince AG that they should go, you know, steal the NX beta. And I mean, he's sort of looking out. I don't know if you pay attention, he's sort of looking up and outward into space, even while they're inside that hangar.
Mm.
But he's selling this speech about why they have to keep going, they have to keep fighting, they have to prove that this can work. I don't know that I would have, you know, none of the other captains could have really done it that way. He has such a powerful way with words that when they write a great speech for him, Bakula can really nail it.
Yeah,
well, and they're not...
That bit when he's looking at the hangar reminded me of the bit in Nemesis when Patrick Stewart is talking to basically himself because he's talking to his younger versions, and they're on about the bit where he used to look at the sky and wonder what's out there. Mm. That reminded me of that.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And the longer version of that scene before it got cut down is really excellent too. I don't know if you've seen that cut of it, but yeah, Patrick Stewart does nail it when he talks about Picard's being explorers.
Yeah.
And the great thing about Archer is when he's delivering that scene, it's not flowery. It's just powerful. Mm-hmm. And you know, he doesn't have to be a wordsmith like Picard is, but he's able to sell you because he believes it from the very core of his being. And I think that that's what, again, makes him such a great character. And Bakula just sells it the whole way.
He works really well in this with Keith Carradine as well.
Oh, he's perfect.
He plays AG.
Perfect.
I mean, it's brilliant casting.
Yeah, I want to see this guy as, you know, a regular on that series we never got, where he and Archer are bros and Trip's there too, but they're both working towards it. He's so good. I love him as a foil. They're kind of frenemies, the way this goes, and I really love that relationship.
Let's talk a little bit more about Archer. In the other side of the room...
The other side of the room.
We were talking about Archer as a proto-Kirk. And Matthew, I think you brought that up first. Tell us a little bit more about Archer as a proto-Kirk.
Well, I was thinking about, you know, what AG tells Archer. He's like, you know why you didn't get this. You didn't get this because you're so focused on getting it, being the best pilot. But don't you understand? Starfleet's not looking for the best pilot. They're looking for the best captain. And the best captain is not going to be somebody who's just by the book and working a billion hours and not spending any time investing in the people around him. He's going to be the guy who thinks outside the box. He's going to be the guy who's a little bit roguish. He's going to be the guy who might balk at the rules every once in a while, because that's what it calls for. That's what it means to be a good leader, to be able to inspire people. And what really changes in this episode, I mean, you know, Kirk is, when he's in the academy, he is very much this kind of bookish person. He's very worried about getting good grades. You know, we hear about that. But something changes in him so that by the time he gets to be captain of the Enterprise, he's this maverick. He is very much this kind of right stuff. And then we see this in Archer. He changes in this episode. And so he even tells T'Pol, she's like, I can't believe that you would have had to have been talked into this. And he's like, well, I was a little more by the book then. You know, this Archer that we get here is really that proto-Kirk. He's laying the framework for what it's going to mean to be a captain in Starfleet.
Now hold on a minute, Matt. You're not saying that Kirk would steal a starship.
I'm saying that Kirk got this idea from Archer.
It's very possible.
So it's in the Archer handbook. How to be a starship captain. Step one, nick one.
Exactly. See, what's going to happen is they're going to do a special edition of Star Trek III, The Search for Spock, and Kirk is going to be watching recordings of Archer stealing the NX-01 program so he can get some pointers on how to do it.
Well, it's too bad they didn't have the holodeck in those days so he could enter the room and actually follow along with them as they steal the NX beta.
Well, we all know that if Kirk had the holodeck, he'd never come out. Especially if he was...
Nothing would ever get done.
Especially if he was with T'Pol.
Well, he'd just be loading constant porn programs up all the time, wouldn't he? You know, Reg Barkley wouldn't get a look in.
Yeah.
You know, he'd be going down and you know, Picard would be calling Reg Barkley up and saying, you know, what are you putting in these programs? Well, I found him under the secret format, Kirk extra.
Yeah. So, you know, for some reason, I have a feeling that... And you might not imagine this, but I think that the Valeris program would be quite popular with Kirk. Do you get that feeling a little bit?
Yeah.
In the undiscovered country?
Yeah.
I don't
understand the meaning of this picture. Shut up and drink these.
Yeah. He would have been playing with the Savick program as well, because we all know who you felt about her. So.
But yeah, linking him to Kirk, I mean, we've got this bar fight. You know, everyone's sitting around drinking their Budweiser classics, just like in Space Adventure 2009. They have this fight. You've got the bartender. I guess in Space Adventure, it was Uhura saying, that's enough. This is very, very Kirk-like, what Archer goes through in this episode.
The Andorians in the back throwing punches at people that aren't even in the fight.
I've been attacked by an Andorian.
Right. Oh, he's in the background. Okay, well, the fight, of course, is between Archer and Robinson. And... they had, like you said, Greg, they're kind of frenemies here. There's a lot of competition going on.
But yes, it's not like a real fight, though. It's like, you know, they're colleagues, but it's building up. They've got this argument that they're not having that's building. They just have to have a bro fight so they can work out their feelings.
Well, it's kind of like brothers fighting, too, sometimes,
yeah.
I think.
Yeah. It's like you don't fight your brother because you hate him. You fight him because sometimes you just have to fight to work through things.
It's the alpha male thing.
Yeah.
That's basically what it is.
And then, you know, Archer tells T'Pol, sometimes, you know, humans have a funny way of becoming friends. And this really kind of galvanizes the fact that they're not going to be enemies. They're going to be friends. They're going to be on the same side. But yeah, you kind of have to, for them, they had to get out that, I just kind of need to kick your ass right now because you've been annoying me and this is your fault. And hey, you trashed my dad and his engine, so.
Yeah.
Yeah, which goes into what Craig was saying about him being frenemies.
Right, right. Like, I don't think they hate each other. They didn't want to actually hurt each other. And it definitely galvanized what they had. they instantly became a team after that.
Nothing like two cracked molars to bring you together.
Right.
Right. You can do anything with leeches. That's something I learned from Flux. That's why I keep a big jar of leeches over here in the studio all the time. You know, the kids come in, fell down on the steps coming back from school. Hey, have a leech.
And then rub some dirt on it. It'll be fine.
Yeah. I can always feed it to my bat if it don't work.
Well, the engines bring us to Trip, and they're giving us the story now about how Archer and Trip met and how they got to be buddies. And I think, Greg, you have a little bit of a problem with this whole story, don't you?
Yeah, and I wish I had more in my notes. I was trying to find where it was, but I know there's later on in the series where they specifically say that Archer didn't know Trip way back when. But I love this version of it. I love showing, you know, Trip on the team. I guess he's actually working for Jefferies at this point, which is phenomenal. I love that reference to the original series. Trip's role in this is fantastic. I would have hated for them to leave him out for any sort of continuity reasons. He's really excellent. I love how he just yells at the Vulcans. You know, they're complaining that the engine just is clearly unsound. He says, "No, it's not unsound." It's that sort of gung-ho attitude that I think Archer realized he needed to be more like that kid and a little less by the book.
I think that, Colin, do you know exactly what Greg's talking about later on? Because my feeling is that it wasn't really fleshed out, but I always had this feeling that they alluded to the fact that Archer and Trip go way back. You know, they've known each other for a long time. They go way back, although we didn't get any details. So I'm thinking maybe the instance where they really go against that later on, that is the anomaly
right.
in the storytelling rather than this going against the norm.
There is elements in later episodes where they kind of hint that they kind of knew each other at the academy, if not at college. But it's not actually like, it's not actually tied down. It's just alluded to.
Right.
Yeah. So that's probably what Craig's got in the back of his head somewhere.
Yeah, I'll have to pay attention during my next viewing to find exactly what it was. But either way, I love the idea that they did know each other. It's excellent. You know, sometimes this sort of thing makes the world smaller. You know, the idea of having Anakin build C-3PO.
The maker of Master Annie. I knew you would return.
It makes the universe a little bit smaller. But having Archer know Trip back when they were building this NX, I think that's really excellent. That's exactly what would make sense.
Well, it explains why he would choose Trip as his engineer.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, well, he did promise him, didn't he, that if he ever got his own ship.
Oh, he does, yeah.
Well, and it would explain, too, why, you know, a lot of people kind of malign Trip in the first, you know, season, maybe into the second season a little bit. But this would explain why Archer is sold out to Trip. Like, he has complete faith in Trip. And one, because he's known him for a really long time. Actually, you know, they actually did survival training together in Australia. Trip taught him how to scuba dive in Florida. So they have known each other for a long time. Yeah.
There was that time when they stood in line for 2 days together to get the iPhone 12.
Exactly, yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. And he taught him how to pan fry catfish.
Exactly.
Right.
But I think that this is one of those things. This story really sells me on the character of Trip and just how special he is. Because you can see that this guy can do anything. I mean, the guy's a hacker. I mean, he's hacking into things. He's obviously a fantastic engineer. He's working with Captain Jefferies. He's the kind of guy who can figure out some things when other people can't, especially when it comes to this warp mixture idea and getting the intermix just right. I mean, you can see here.
He runs the whole launch from like a laptop on a little stand in the middle of the...
Yeah, apparently you give Trip an iPad and he could rule the world. I mean, so...
It's quite frightening, isn't it?
You want to go warp 2.2? There's an app for that.
There's a cave in that.
Yeah, I like the backstory there because, you know, Archer and Trip are always from the beginning just very, very friendly. I don't know why people malign Trip. I think he's possibly, especially early on, the strongest character on the show.
Yeah, yeah. And this I think Enterprise, at a lot of times, is the Trip show. Yeah. And this is clearly a case where he steals the show. Like I say, he teaches Archer quite a bit. You know, they sort of meet midway through the episode, and then you see Archer sitting down to beers with him later on, and he's sort of a changed guy. He's no longer this lone wolf who spends all of his time, you know, doing the simulations over and over and over again. Now he's being a little bit more out there. He's talking with more people. He's doing more things. He's becoming a captain, and a lot of it is because he meets Trip.
Did I just hear you say he sits down with Tiberius? Now, is that one of the Vulcans that's scowling at them in the control room?
That's the scowling one. Yeah, okay. It's Tiberius.
Tiberius. All right.
That's really awesome is the fact that Trip he's the first one to kind of get in the Vulcan's face. And if you watch, that really fires up Archer to continue with pursuing this. And Trip's kind of really the catalyst for that. And so, you know, Greg, I think you're right on. Archer sees something in this guy that he almost wishes he had. And I think he learns a little bit from Trip as well.
Yeah. He doesn't just do the launch with the laptop. I mean, he blocks all the sensors with the laptop at the same time as doing the launch with the laptop. So,
yeah. Right. He didn't even need Uhura to stick a security guy in the closet.
No. This is the guy I want to plan a bank heist with because, man.
Yeah.
Of course, you do know in the deleted scenes there is a section where Trip distracts the guards by doing a feather dance.
Oh, I'm glad they cut that part out.
I was so looking forward to that. I got my Blu-rays pre-ordered already, so I'm...
Because that scene in HD is excellent.
Yeah.
But the weird part about that is that even though when they filmed it, it was actually Connor Trinneer singing... In the actual scene, they dubbed the audio. It's not actually him singing as he does the feather dance.
It's weird. That's actually where the Jeffrey Combs is in the episode.
Oh, that's it.
Jeffrey Combs is singing. Connor Trinneer is doing the feather dance.
Jeffrey Combs is actually the feathers.
Yeah.
That's right. I didn't even recognize him.
He is everywhere.
Yeah. Well, Combs' voice is just magical, and Connor's body is obviously magical. So you put those two together, it is just a magical experience.
Oh, man. No kidding.
Okay. Well,
do you think DePaul was listening to the story and sort of saying, man, okay, Archer, you did some cool stuff. That AG guy sounds wonderful. But that Charles Tucker... Now that's a guy I want to sleep with.
Yeah. That's the guy who can have my panfish.
That's the guy I want to have my evil clone baby with.
That's the guy I'm going to teach neural pressure to.
Yeah. And I will spend extra time in the decon chamber playing with his cream.
Yes.
All right. Okay, let's talk about T'Pol a little bit then. And... just what this episode did overall for the relationship between T'Pol and Archer, because it's very, from the beginning, I mean, he basically, well, I guess he hates T'Pol in the beginning of the series, really, mm-hmm. because he doesn't like Vulcans. He's very harsh towards her. And, you know, I mean, it's kind of tense for a while, but yeah, this was a moment where we do get to see them. It's almost like, Archer and T'Pol's shuttle pod one. Here, only they don't get under the blankets together, but they, you know, they spend a lot of time together in this shuttle pod and get to know each other a bit.
Yeah, that's quite true. I mean, T'Pol sort of starts as, you know, that officer the KJB puts on your submarine just to keep an eye on you, make sure you're doing the right stuff. I mean, that's clearly what T'Pol is when the show begins. And it's really a case of her proving herself as a valuable member of the crew. And this is a case of, you know, Trip doesn't go with Archer in the shuttle pod. She goes, and she's the one who shares these intimate moments with Archer as he's dealing with the loss of a friend.
So basically, T'Pol went wrong because she never had tea in a glass.
There you go.
I think that this is one of those things, too, that, you know, Trip can go with Archer, and the story's not going to come out because Archer doesn't have anything to say to Trip. But by T'Pol going and being the good first officer, caring for the captain, she gives him the opportunity to talk about what he needs to talk about. And what I thought was really interesting is you can tell how far T'Pol has come in this episode. She's really beginning to understand humans. She's beginning to understand when Archer needs to get something off his chest and just talk about something, because she even says, do you want to talk about it? Or I can meditate. And she knows what's going to happen. She knows that Archer's not going to be able to resist kind of letting it out. And he needs this. He needs this kind of catharsis. And so I think that this episode does a great job of kind of cementing their relationship as first officer and captain, and that it's just going to be first officer and captain. There's not going to be anything else going on.
Yeah. Yeah. Feels very much like a loyalty mission in Mass Effect. And she's having to ask just the right questions of him to get him to tell the story so that he can trust her for later on. It feels very important, and she plays it just right. I mean, she doesn't push him too hard. She doesn't act disinterested too much, just enough to make him reveal himself to her.
There's also a degree of empathy in it, which is unnatural for a Vulcan, because she gives him just enough of a nudge to get him to say what he wants to say. You know, so she helps him to open up, which is what a friend would do. But from a Vulcan to have that level of empathy is unreal.
And she makes that.
Obviously, she hasn't done Colin on. She hasn't got the fancy necklace yet, so that's probably why.
Well, this is why, you know, when they meet other Vulcans, they're commenting on how much she has changed. You know, you really spend enough time with humans, eventually you're going to smell like one of them. That's sort of what's happened to T'Pol here.
She does a great job of getting him to open up, and she's even learned, kind of like Spock did, to be able to tease him. You know, she gives the nice joke about, oh, I guess we'll never know. And he's like, what? Who would have won the fight? And I think that that's very funny, because she's found a way to be able to relate to humans on their level. And yes, being the Vulcan to spend the most time now with humans has had a huge impact on her. And I think in a lot of ways for the better.
Yeah, even though she was in the Vulcan compound on Earth, you get the feeling in the early episodes that the Vulcans never left the compound.
Right.
So they never had that interaction with humanity.
Well, why would you want to leave the compound when you've got those, you know, kick-ass Vulcan parties going on?
You might want to go and fight an Andorian.
Ain't no party like a Vulcan party, because a Vulcan party don't stop.
There you go.
That's because everybody's just standing there awkwardly. They don't want to be the first.
Scowling at each other.
They don't want to be the first person to leave, because they know that would be rude. So everybody just kind of sips their tea and, you know, silently. Yeah,
the standing sign. I do not understand this music. What does it mean?
I didn't know there were this many candles in San Francisco. Where'd all these candles come from?
They must have done wonders for the candle industry in San Francisco. You know, you're a candle maker. Sure, you've got a few here and there, but the Vulcans go through like 20, 30 of those a piece, like per day.
Yeah. You have to imagine that the fire insurance on the Vulcan compound must have just been astronomical.
That bloke outside the Vulcan embassy gates that was selling candles, he's a multimillionaire now.
Oh, yeah.
They had the best fire suppression system anywhere in the galaxy.
That's what they've been doing instead of mapping dark matter nebulas.
Creating fire suppression systems.
Yes, exactly. Developing more and better candles.
Well, and we do. Yeah. I mean, I don't want to forget here. I mean, we need to mention this about Vulcans. Apparently, Vulcan Love Slave is the most popular holodeck program ever and storyline ever, because we still hear about this, you know, in the Next Generation, Deep Space Nine, Voyager. Yeah. And so,
I mean, that's true.
They apparently have some very interesting times behind those walls they don't want us to know about.
Apparently.
Yeah. Barclay ran Vulcan Love Slave 20 times more.
That's actually true. Now, that's not just Matthew making up something. That program is mentioned quite often in Star Trek.
Yeah.
It's in books and all. It's not just in the TV. It's in the books as well.
Yeah.
Well, I'm sure it's in plenty of fan fiction, Colin.
Oh, it's in plenty of fan fiction. But normally the fan fiction involves Kirk and Spock.
The best are the picture books you can get.
Oh, goodness.
Yeah.
Do you think the Vulcan compound has like a whole, like it's like level 8 where you go whenever you're having your ponfar and just everybody, it's just very, very free and loose down there?
I think so, yeah. Level 8. Yeah.
You got to watch using the number 8 though, Greg, because you end up in other podcasts.
That's right. Apparently, Greg and I are becoming sound clips on deck 8.
No, you are.
I didn't even know.
Yeah. I just started editing deck 8 before we started this, and it's already in there. So. Wow.
8 times the fun, guys. 8 times the fun.
Oh, goodness.
Yeah.
Exactly. Well, could we talk a little bit about the NX program itself? I mean, we touched on it with like the Vulcans standing around in their robes. But it is an interesting thing that we're seeing sort of that midway point, as you say, between what Cochrane was doing and where we end up. I mean, even this NX ship itself still looks like the Phoenix. Like, it looks like they even used the cockpit set from First Contact.
It has got an engineering change, though, because if you look at it on the launch sequence, the flames for the rocket sequence actually come from the warp nacelles.
Oh, do they?
Yeah.
Well, I know for the Phoenix, the nacelles sort of come out. They're sort of a surprise in the third act that the side of the missile and then the nacelles come out. In this one, the nacelles do this cool unfurling thing where they're close to the side, then they release. That effect shot of the NX Beta lifting off on that accelerator pad and launching, that's one of the best effect shots I've ever seen. And it's only like 2 shots that we ever see this big launch, whatever you call it, launch track.
Yeah, it's really good. And I think that what was really neat is, again, getting to see that kind of progression from Cochrane to the NX-01 and giving us this picture of what it was like to put this program together. And the fact that, you know, the Vulcans are doing anything and everything they can to derail this program. I mean, they're going to choose any path they can to make sure that they can slow humans down. And I love the way that, you know, Trip challenges them. Look, just because it took you 100 years doesn't mean it's going to take us 100 years. And I think Vulcans are almost scared out of their mind at the thought of us being in space sooner. But I thought that was really just a great way of giving us a picture of what this was like and the struggles and why, you know, Trip and Archer have such kind of a hatred at the beginning of the show for Vulcans, you know, especially Archer, whose father never gets to see his engine be put to use because he's died before this has happened. And it really is the Vulcans' fault because they've been holding humans back.
Well, I mean, on one level they are. On another level, they are watching out for the safety. I mean, if they just handed us the technology, like Janeway hands the Hirogen the holodeck technology, you know, we would have done crazy, crazy things starting at warp 5 or wherever the Vulcans were at that point. By making us build it ourselves, they were following that Ian Malcolm, you know, course of logic where you have to build it yourself. And the Vulcans were guiding us. So I hate to see us demonize the Vulcans too much. But at the same time, places like this where they're so ready just to say, shut it all down. Just shut it down. Don't even try again. It must be flawed. They do, I admit, go a bit overboard.
Yeah. And we all know what happened when the Hirogen got, you know, holodeck technology. They all turned into Nazis. So that's where the Empire was. The Imperial was born.
Right.
I think both points are valid, though, that on the one hand, yes, I do think the Vulcans, well, they actually say this in The Forge and that trilogy there, that they are scared of humans. I mean, that's... They see that humans progress through things much more quickly than they did. They also see that volatile nature in humans that the Vulcans themselves possess. And I do think they are very worried about humans getting out into the galaxy too quickly before their instincts catch up with their technological advancement,
right. Yeah.
Which is, of course, a problem we see in our world.
You've got that bit where Spot mentioned that the Vulcan war was violent even by human standards.
Yeah, all right, right.
Well, what's so interesting too, though, is that if Vulcans had had their way, the humans would not have been there to stop things like their war with Andoria that would have happened and all of these kind of things that would have happened because humans hadn't been there talk reason into, you know, the Andorians, the Vulcans, the Tellarites. It's because we're there, because we actually have experience with war so close in our history, that we understand what violence really means. And we're willing to help other people talk it out before they go into this kind of bloody mess that they're creating for themselves, because they haven't had war on their planets for so long that they kind of forget what it's like. And that Vulcan would have shot itself in the foot, basically, if it really had gotten what it wanted, because we wouldn't have been there to help them stop themselves.
No. And you've also got to remember, if it wasn't for Archer and the Warp 5 ship, Jeffrey Coombs would have missed out on two parts.
That's right. Right. The other point I wanted to come back to, though, was what Greg's describing. I think the NX program is very important, that you do need to develop this yourself. You know, I think anytime you're handed something, it can be very dangerous. And it's the process of experimenting, the process of learning and developing, that helps you learn how to control something or how to manage either your life or technology. One I always come back to is, okay, so in university, you know, my degree is in Russian language, but I don't use Russian. I ended up being a designer. And most of my friends, they don't work in the fields that they studied in the university. I think the value in university is the process of spending 4 or 5 years learning about yourself, learning how to interact with others, learning about the general world, how to manage your time, you know, how to manage life. And what you do afterwards is a bit different. And as an analogy here, I think the NX program is important for humans to go through all the steps of developing this warp technology themselves. Sure, the Vulcans could give it to us and we could just jump ahead, and that'd be great, but we would miss out on all the important aspects that come with the process of discovery and learning.
A professor told me, he says that university is, it's not about learning about your subject, it's about learning about yourself.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
Well, and humans learn best from adversity. We learn best from, you know, suffering, really. When we go through those really hard times in our life, those are the things that really teach us something. You know, honestly, we don't get taught a lot by just having a good time and a ton of successes in a row. We learn by having to go through really tough times. And, you know, in some ways, I feel like the Vulcans are trying to take that away from us as humans. And we know what's going to help us learn. And I think that's kind of what Archer and AG and Trip are fighting for. Look, we understand how we learn best. We are learning from our past. We don't want to move too far ahead. But we also know that if we don't do this ourselves, if we don't push forward, we're not going to learn what we need to learn. So we're not going to be ready for when we get into space. And this program really helps us learn what it means, the cost of getting into space. You know, and if somebody dies along the way, it's going to be a reminder to us how much this has cost us. And we take it, we hold it to our hearts more dearly. It's precious to us. You know, if we're just kind of given things, you know, that's definitely not what's going to help humanity. And in some ways, again, if the Vulcans had gotten their way, I don't know if we would have been as ready as Archer is to be out there. I think he might have been an even worse captain because he hadn't gone through some adversity. I think this story shows we need that kind of challenge to really mold us and shape us, you know, to be brought through the fire.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's like if you go into basically NASA and you had the Challenger disaster, and they learn from that and move on. If you go back to the Aquarius program and the Mercury program, their setbacks they had there where people died, but they learned from it and they moved on. And that's what humans do. They learn from our mistakes and we move on. It's, was it Roosevelt who said, those who don't learn from history are doomed to repeat it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that's what humans do. If you fast forward to TNG, Guinan says to Q, they're adaptable. That's their strength. And that's what humanity is all about. We make a mistake. We look at it. We think, okay, messed up there. Won't do that again. Let's try it this way. And that's what we do.
Yeah. I really would like to see
those really, really early days, you know, right after the Vulcans step off the ship and talk with them, what exactly did they do? Did they say, you know, now you need to set up a warp program, we'll help you out? Like, did they come in and say, we'll help you? Or did they show up and say, no, 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 slow down, slow down? I feel like it probably started as more of a, we're going to work together on this. And sorry, we can't share any technology, but we're totally going to be there helping you out. And what we're seeing in Enterprise, even in this episode, is after that relationship has soured. And I think it's a lot of it is just our impatience with, okay, we understand you're trying to help us. We understand we don't want to, you know, jump too far forward, but we really, really, really want to be out in space. We want to be doing warp. Why aren't you doing more? Why aren't you? So we're already seeing it after years and years of it and getting sick and tired of it. And that's, I think, why this relationship got so bad, because the Vulcans, they, as far as they're concerned, they're helping. They're taking valuable time that they could be spending finding dark matter nebulas. And instead, they're keeping us from destroying ourselves. And we're these ungrateful little pricks who are saying, you're holding us back. So I feel for both sides at this point.
Tying the Vulcans into TNG, then, how do you all feel about the fact when Q says that you've overreached yourselves in the opening of TNG? How do you feel that ties into what the Vulcans are doing now in Enterprise?
Well, I think it's a really good point. I mean, I think Kirk was very much out of his depth, and TNG is there a lot of the times too. They're not prepared for what's out there, and they do really need a guiding hand. You know, by the time of TNG, the Vulcans can't be guiding them because humans have already surpassed what the Vulcans had done.
But I think one of the things that Enterprise points out is the weakness of what the Vulcans are doing is they never get the opportunity to understand humans. And this is where T'Pol comes in. She's the first one to actually spend extended time to get to know us and what makes us tick, to understand who we are and how we grow. And this is really important, and Vulcans never do this. So what they do is they constantly kind of treat us like petulant children instead of treating us as people that are equals. And yes, they may be ahead of us technologically, but we're different species-wise. And so how we grow and what we do and how we learn is going to be different than Vulcans. So they tend to treat us as Vulcan children, and we're not the same. And I think that this is where T'Pol comes in, and she's such an important character for the Star Trek mythos because she's the first Vulcan to spend time with us, get to know us, and we see that in this episode, how she knows Archer. She knows how to kind of prod him along to move him where he needs to go and give him the opportunity to open up to her and let go of this pain that he's feeling of the loss of his friend. I think it's really powerful. If Vulcans had spent more time really trying to get to know us the way we tried to get to know them, it might have been very different. This relationship might not have soured.
Yeah, because the difference with Spock is half human, so he's already exposed to humans via his mother. But it's T'Pol, pure Vulcan.
Yeah, that's a good point. Well, we are coming up on an hour here, so there's so much more to talk about in this episode, which is fantastic, and I think shows how good the stories are on Enterprise. But we should wrap up for today. So why don't we go into final thoughts? And Greg, what are your final thoughts on First Flight? And don't forget, we need to rate this episode.
Oh, yes. Oh, of course. I already have that ready. I really love First Flight. When, you know, we were looking at what episodes to do, and this one definitely jumped out at me as one that I love from the show. It's that second season, but not... Second season sort of took a downturn. It wasn't quite as solid as first season, but it had a few of these episodes where they were trying something different. I think it's really excellent. I love the interplay between Archer and AG. I love the interplay between Archer and T'Pol. And I wish there'd been a little bit more, but that Archer and Trip relationship, as we talked about it being so important, it's really great seeing it in this episode, seeing the very genesis of it, as well as just seeing, you know, more of that lost century, you know, between Zefram Cochrane and Enterprise. It's really excellent. This is one of the episodes I wouldn't say you should watch this before watching the rest of Enterprise. Like I'd say with like Andorian Incident, you could jump in there. but it is an episode that I point to people and say, you know, once you've gotten to second season, there's going to be episodes like First Flight that you have to see as a Star Trek fan. You know, it's not just, oh yeah, Enterprise happened. No, you really have to see an episode like First Flight. So I definitely give this episode 10 intermix fluctuations out of 10.
Excellent. All right. How about you, Colin? What are your final thoughts?
I really like this episode. I also like the way it pays homage to space law, like the 602 Club. The 602 Club is actually named after some students' business bar in Madison, and they also tie in one of the people who was working on the set was actually on the USS Enterprise, the aircraft carrier. So they pay a lot of homage to other incarnations of the space flight. Like Matt said, they reused the Phoenix shell. But I also like the interplay between T'Pol and Archer. You see the development of the friendship. You find out about Tripp and Archer's early days to a certain extent. And you also get to see how the Vulcans, while helping us, only appear to help us to a certain extent. And then they want to stop us. Because that's, you know, baby steps. We want you to take baby steps. We don't need to take giant steps. But there's some great character moments in it. I love the character set pieces in Star Trek. So there's some great character moments in it. There's some great interplay into it. There's some brilliant acting in it. And I would give these 9 commander jumpsuits.
Excellent. How about you, Matthew?
Well, I think I was talking about it on the other side of the room.
The other side of the room.
I think that this is probably my favorite Enterprise episode. It's the one that I've revisited the most. And it's really because this is such a character-driven piece. It gives us the background for Archer, for a great character growth moments for T'Pol, for Tripp. You know, the kind of the trinity of this show. The genesis of the relationship with, you know, Tripp and Archer. It gives us the first mention of a Commodore in Star Trek since the original series. So I think that's great as well, just kind of paying homage to the original series. And but what I really like is the fact that we get to see this time period that we've never seen before. This is completely new territory. And getting to see that right stuff of Enterprise, you know, what it's like to be a test pilot for the NXO program, just how dangerous it was for these guys. I think this is excellent. And so when it comes to Enterprise episodes, I think this is really, you know, just for me, it's the cream of the crop. I can't highly rate it enough. And so I guess for a rating, I would give this 10 out of 10 Ruby's drinks.
Excellent. Well, you guys have pretty much summed it all up. So my final thoughts will be short. Archer says something in here, which I think sums up how he became the captain he is that we see in Enterprise and why this story is important to establishing his character and showing that development, what the influences are. And he says, one thing I learned from AG, you're never going to get anywhere without taking risks. And that just comes back, you know, to what we talked about with Proto Kirk, that maybe he was a bit stiff, a bit by the book at that point, but, you know, AG taught him what it takes to really be a great leader and a great captain. And that's there. And the other thing that we didn't talk about is, I think this episode again highlights that LeVar Burton is one of the greatest directors of Star Trek episodes.
Absolutely.
I love this episode, and I'm going to give this one 9 cracked molars.
That's great.
All right. So we have, again, a full Trek FM panel today, but our listeners, Colin, may not know about you quite as much as some of our other regulars like Char, since you're not on this particular show that often. Take a moment, tell everybody about what you do, where to find you.
Well, we've got 2 podcasts on the Trek FM network. There's Decade, which is a dedicated Star Trek online podcast, which comes out every Wednesday or Thursday. And there's Trek News and Views, which is basically a discussion-based show. where we talk about anything and everything to do with Star Trek and go off on unbelievable tangents, very similar to the Ready Room in some respects, but not as refined, shall we say. and if they want to follow me, they can follow me on Twitter at COLMH01.
And what was the name that you were given? Who said this? That you were the Supreme Commander of Trek FM Europe?
Oh, Supreme Commander Trek FM Europe. Yeah, that was Max and Mike from Commentary Trek Stars.
Okay. Yeah, all right. Right, and you were our representative at the recent Destination Star Trek London.
Yes, yes. Doing a lot of networking and plugging Facebook.
And your brother represented us at Destination Star Trek Stratford-upon-Avon, right? But we didn't get much news from that for some reason.
I can't think why. I mean, Greg did a real good job of plugging Stratford-upon-Avon as well. I don't know what went wrong there.
We did. No one gave that convention more publicity than we did. That I am certain of. All right. Well, Matthew, tell everyone where they can find you.
Yes, of course, you can find me at Trek FM, do the book reviews, as well as I am on The Orb, which are dedicated Deep Space Nine podcast with you, Chris, and also Literary Treks, our dedicated podcast to comics and books with you as well. And then, of course, I am on Twitter at MattRushing02, so give me a follow there, talking about all sorts of different things, and those are the places you can find me.
Excellent. Well, thanks a lot for joining us today, guys.
Yeah, thanks for having me on.
Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
So Matthew gave the episode, I think, 10 drinks from Ruby. I'm hoping those were bourbons straight up, A.G. Robinson's drink of choice. I love the drinking in this episode. We didn't really get to talking about that, but everybody had their own special thing that they drank, and I loved Robinson's bourbons.
Yeah, I could go for a few of those myself. That sounds good. It was a lot of fun talking about this episode, and as we got to the end of it, I just realized how much more there was we could cover in that episode. Yeah. And I still don't understand how people don't like Enterprise. That's basically what I come away with when I watch Enterprise.
Yeah, it's frustrating. I mean, there was so much for us to talk about, like the sets. You know, we talked about it kind of feels like a bottle show because it's Archer and T'Pol in the shuttle pod, but they built so much. They actually used some sets from another show. But aside from that, it just felt so realistic. You know, inside those NX betas, it feels like the Millennium Falcon with all of those buttons and switches all around them.
Yeah, that's the thing. And exterior, too. I didn't mention this during the discussion, but that scene early on when Archer and T'Pol leave in the shuttle and it leaves the NX-01, it flies under the saucer and it heads out, it looks so real. It's like you feel like you could be in space and you're looking at real ships. There's this tangible nature to those effects on Enterprise that they don't feel futuristic like Next Generation and the later series in the timeline do.
Yep.
It's just really beautifully done. It's one thing I love about Enterprise.
Yeah, and that's part of why I really can't wait for that Blu-ray to really see the detail in those effects. It's going to be amazing. Netflix is still a little fuzzy and there's a little bit of choppiness.
Yeah.
Can't wait to see those pristine files.
Because the lighting is so good on Enterprise when they do these ships, to be able to see all that fine detail.
Yeah, it's some of the best effects work ever done on television. And it's astounding that it was over 10 years ago.
Right? Yeah, it is amazing. All right, well, let's tell everyone where to contact us if they want to share their thoughts on Enterprise, First Flight, anything we talked about in news today. You can go to trek.fm/contact. There's a form there. You can choose to send to a show, send it to the Ready Room, and that'll come to Greg and myself. You can go over to our new forums, which are now open at trek.fm/forums, and there's a section there just for the Ready Room, and you can talk to us about the shows and share your thoughts there if you prefer to do that. And you can also go to Facebook. We have a very quickly growing community there. It's facebook.com/trekfm. And as always, on Twitter, under username TrekFM, where Greg and myself and Shar and Landru are tweeting from that account. Now, Greg, what if people want to find you?
Well, they can definitely find me at two places mainly. One of them is here on Trek FM, as well as the Ready Room. I do another show called The Observation Lounge, which is sort of the off-duty for Trek FM members, where we can talk about anything and everything else but Star Trek. It's an awful lot of fun, so check that out. As well as on the Twitter, I'm there at Greg Harbin. That's GregHarbin. Where I'll be talking a lot about Skylanders, as well as, just like our own international sex symbol, Tristan. He got some glasses last week. I'm following suit with some glasses this week. So you can look forward to seeing the very first pictures of me into glasses. Hopefully they won't be those lens flare glasses that you talked about in news.
Oh, yeah. They're a little pricey. You wanted to spend that money on your Enterprise Blu-ray sets. Right.
Now, I am hoping they do a 3D conversion on the glasses, because I'm sick of this just really flat world that I'm living in.
Right, yeah. I tell you, when they finally make life 3D, that's just going to be
it's going to be really amazing.
Awesome. All right. Well, if you want to find me, I am on Twitter. My username is C. Brian Jones. That's Brian with a Y. And you can find me pretty much anywhere in social media under that username. Just go to whatever site you like and look me up. You can find me elsewhere on the network here doing Literary Treks, which Matthew mentioned at the end of the feature, as well as The Orb, where we talk about Deep Space Nine, and my occasional interview show, Matterstream, if you want to go back and listen to me talk to people like Rod Roddenberry and Anthony Montgomery and scientists like Seth Shostak. You can head over and find that at trek.fm/ms. All right, and Greg, of course, we want to give a huge thank you to our sponsor, Squarespace, and encourage everyone to go check out the platform. It is absolutely the best way to create websites or blogs.
Yeah, little known fact, when Tripp was running the launch of the NX beta from his laptop, he was actually using Squarespace 24, which is a really powerful product that Squarespace will be coming out with in about 150 years. So go ahead and get in on the ground floor now. You'll be amazed at what's to come.
So there you go. That's how you know Squarespace is the most solid and reliable platform. Because if the NX program relies on it, you should too. So you go on over there now. Squarespace.com/trek and use offer code TREK2 to get 10% off your purchase when you sign up. And you can try it free for 14 days, no credit card required. And give it a test drive, and I promise you, you'll love it. And you'll want to sign up. And you'll be helping our sponsor, and you'll be helping us bring you this programming at the same time. Well, Greg, speaking of the NX program, while Archer and AJ are out there doing their little test flight after they've stolen the ship, I think Ruby's alone in the bar, so I'm going to go over there and see if she's got plans for the rest of the night.
All right, Chris. I think it's time to load 6 dark matter probes into it, because the ready room is done.
I think he probably would have been playing with the Sarek program, or the, not Sarek program, cut that. He would have been playing with the Savik program as well, because we all know.
No, leave the Sonic bit in.